Now, from Mayo Clinic, it's Medical Edge Weekend, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. Plus, we'll take you beyond the headlines for in-depth discussions of what developments in medicine mean to you. Information you want from specialists who know. Join the conversation by phone, through our blog, or on Twitter by going to radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McCray.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Welcome, everyone, to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, this is February still, and of course it's famous for Valentine's Day, and I'm sure you got something from your Valentine. You don't even have to talk about it.
I won't.
All right. And February is also American Heart Month, and heart disease is still the leading cause of death for both men and women. It kills close to 750,000 people every year in the United States. In fact, there's about a 1 out of 4 chance that's what you're going to die of,
wow,
heart disease. And, you know, you have to die of something, I guess, but you don't want to die prematurely of heart disease. And you don't really need to know how your heart works. You just need to know how to keep it from stopping.
That's right.
80% of heart disease, here's the most important thing, and here's what we want to emphasize today with today's guest. 80% of heart disease is preventable and or controllable.
That's right. There's a few things we should all know about heart disease and how to prevent it. Today's guest is women's heart expert, Dr. Rekha Mankad. We'll find out why heart disease is so common. We'll talk about the risk factors and who's likely to get heart disease. And we'll tell you some pretty simple, straightforward things that you can do to prevent it. Really, just a few things you can do can dramatically reduce your risk for heart disease. And they are smoking, controlling your blood pressure, the cholesterol issue, of course, and your diet.
And don't forget about exercise. But diet is really important. And we know that diet can play a big role in whether or not you develop heart disease. After all, what do they say? You are what you eat. And, you know, if you want to carry that to the extreme, it's really simple. You just follow the cardiologist diet. And that is, if it tastes good, you spit it out.
Oh, God.
Well, a little later in the hour, we'll talk with Mayo dietitian Ms. Katie Zaratsky, and she's a dietitian, and she will tell us what we should and shouldn't be eating, including the worst foods for your heart.
A couple of my favorites are on there, unfortunately.
You already know the list?
Yes.
I probably had one of them last night.
But first, for the past 5 years, the National Marathon to Finish Breast Cancer has been held in Jacksonville, Florida. In fact, this year it's on February 17th. To date, the event has raised $3 million, with the majority of those funds going towards research in finding a cure for breast cancer. Joining us now, cancer researcher and professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at Mayo Clinic Jacksonville, Dr. E. Aubrey Thompson. Good morning, Dr. Thompson.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very good. Are you going to be running in the race?
No, I'm afraid my running days are long, long over.
All right. Well, why don't you?
Too many of those unheart healthy breakfasts myself.
Well, why don't you tell us what you have found through your marathon research? See what I did there?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. What have you found with that research?
So, as I think you know, that about 70% of the proceeds from the National Marathon end up going to support breast cancer research at Mayo Clinic, and actually supports a wide range of genomic studies of various sorts. So, I think that from a broad sense, I think that largely what we've found, and not just our laboratory, but breast cancer researchers in general have really come to appreciate is the fact that almost every breast cancer, almost every tumor is unique. It's different. And the challenge for effective therapy is to figure out, you know, among all these differences from one woman to the next, what are the key differences and how can we use those key differences to design therapies that are tailored specifically to the various mutations that cause that particular tumor. I think that's the exciting thing that's really going on in 21st century, both cancer research as well as cancer therapy.
One of the things that I have learned through doing this program is that there's two different genetics that are important, the genetics of the patient and the genetics of the tumor. So the tumor itself has its own set of genetics that make a difference in how it's going to be treated. Is that right?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I mean, we actually focus primarily on the genetic architecture of the tumor itself. The genetic architecture of the patient may contribute somewhat to risk of breast cancer, although that's a fairly rare and fairly well-defined set of risk factors. So primarily what we're interested in is what's different about the genomic architecture of the tumor and how can we use those differences to design more effective therapies.
So what you're trying to do right now is figure out what abnormal genes are in the cancer itself and then tailor treatment to that. Have you been successful?
That's absolutely correct.
Have you been successful in doing that to date?
Well, those are two things. Have we been successful in defining what genes are abnormal in the tumors? Yes, we've worked for a long time and very hard with a number of other groups to develop the technology to be able to characterize all of the genomic features of an individual tumor. Have we been able to translate that directly into therapy? No, I think that's tomorrow's objective, but we're not at that point yet.
But the first step was a huge step, and hopefully you'll be able to take the second step in the not too distant future, huh?
Well, absolutely. We're involved in the process of initiating a number of clinical trials that we think are going to make the first important contributions to being able to use individual genetic makeup to predict therapeutic response.
So when the National Marathon is being held, do you have a booth there where people can come and talk with you? I mean, it seems it's, like you said, 70% of the money raised for this marathon goes directly to breast cancer research. Do you get out and meet with some of those people who are helping you raise that money?
Oh, absolutely. As I speak to you, I'm sitting in the Omni Convention Center downtown as a part of a two-day breast cancer marathon whirlwind of activities that are related to the marathon that are involve runners as well as involve breast cancer experts, colon cancer experts, gynecological malignancy experts who present continuing medical education programs for local physicians and exchange ideas about the latest things that are going on in research. So it's a very typical Mayo activity. It involves research, it involves education, and it involves patient interaction. So I think all three of the key shields of the Mayo Clinic philosophy are very adequately represented by the activities that are going on as I sit here.
Well, we hope it's a huge success. Thanks so much for being with us. Dr. E. Aubrey Thompson, yes, you bet. He's at the Omni Convention Center in Jacksonville, Florida, close to Mayo Clinic Jacksonville, and the marathon coming up soon.
That's right.
To raise money for breast cancer.
Right, and that's got to be pretty neat. I mean, they're sitting right there. People are coming in, and they're raising money, and then they get to use that money for research and maybe one day find a cure, a little bit closer to that goal.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll meet women's health expert, Dr. Rekha Mankad. Plus, myth or matter of fact, heart disease is more common among women than men. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our heart specialist at 507-282-1234. You can also contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Tweet us at any time at hashtag Mayo Radio, too. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. This week's guest, a women's health expert, Dr. Rekha Mankad. Dr. Mankad, welcome back to the program. Always good to see you.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, we know that there are some broken hearts this February, women or men who didn't get the Valentine from the Valentine they hoped would send them something or give them something. But what I found very interesting is that you actually can die of a broken heart.
This is the most exciting thing of this whole week, Dr. Mankad.
Forget about heart attacks.
That's right. Yeah. Well, there is something called the broken heart syndrome, and actually it's called Takotsubo, or apical ballooning is the technical terms. And it's a condition where it's not a traditional heart attack. It's not due to plaque rupture, but it's where the heart suddenly gets very weak, and it happens in a very specific pattern usually. And And it's usually after some type of stressful condition, although that's not universal. But for all intents and purposes, it looks like a heart attack when you present to the hospital and gets treated very aggressively. But it's sometime after the fact when you do all the testing that you realize it's not due to a traditional plaque rupture. The good news about that is the heart function can normalize very quickly, but you do have to be aware of the condition. But
do you treat it, or does it just get better on its own?
Well, you do have to treat it in the acute phases, so you do give medicines to make the heart stronger, and then it's a tincture of time, and the heart will get stronger.
I thought you were going to say you have to give him a hug and say it's going to be okay. But it is something that's very serious like that.
It is. It can be very serious. And it presents like a heart attack. And in the initial phases, sometimes you don't know.
Can we say that living here in the land of 10,000 lakes, people like to jump into frozen lakes? And Dr. Mankad told me that can be one of the things that this happens. This is why I don't jump in a frozen lake.
Well, I mean, it's extremely rare. The condition itself is rare, although I do want to say that it is more common in women than men.
Oh, my goodness.
And in middle-aged to women, it's more common. But I do know of a case where a woman developed this after she had jumped into a cold, icy lake to take a swim.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, don't do that. I guess as a man, though, you'll want me to do it for you.
Yeah, go right ahead. Now, you mentioned this. Let's just go right to our myth or matter of fact. Heart disease is more common among women than among men.
See, and this is a great question because actually it gets into the incidence or prevalence of disease. And heart disease is actually more prevalent in men than women, but it is the number one killer of women. Just like men. The issue is the mortality or dying from the disease.
Okay.
Unfortunately, women are dying more often of their heart disease than men.
Now, so how do you explain that?
Well, you know, the risks of a heart disease in women, for some reason, are not adequately addressed a lot of the time. So women are presenting later with their disease. Their symptoms are going unrecognized. So there's a lot of players in this. But yeah, the mortality rates can be double. If you look at a heart attack, women are twice as likely to die of a heart attack compared to a man.
So it would be better to say heart disease is more deadly for women than for men.
That is correct.
Wow.
But what we want to emphasize is what we talked about earlier, and that is that 80% of heart disease is in fact preventable, and 90% of women have one or more risk factors, right? And it's those risk factors that you say sometimes get ignored, both among women and men. So let's talk about those risk factors. What are they, the big
Absolutely.
Ones?
Okay, the big ones. Smoking. Do not
Number
smoke.
One, huh?
Number one, I'm going to tell you, because if you look at the events that happen in women, half can be attributed to tobacco use. So smoking.
Isn't it true that, more younger women are taking up smoking than, say, 5 years ago? I mean, it's becoming more common among young women?
Yeah, that's the group that, unfortunately, we're not making as big strides in, because overall, we are doing up some benefit of people quitting smoking, but women seem to quit at a lower rate than men. And in women, even 1 to 2 cigarettes a day carries an increased risk.
Hmm. Wow. And for some reason, and I don't quite understand it, despite all the education that we have done, younger women, teenage girls, seem to be smoking.
That's true.
Yeah, too bad. All right, but anyway, that's number one on the list.
Okay, that's number one. It's your diet. So very important to have a heart-healthy diet. We want to take in lots of fruits and vegetables, fish, if we can, with omega-3s, and so oily fishes. So the diet is critically important to our heart health. Blood pressure control. If you have high blood pressure, you need to make sure it's treated. People are aware of their blood pressure being elevated, but if you look at the percentage of people taking medicines, it's only about 60%, and those that are getting control of their blood pressure is only 30-35%.
You say they're aware of it. They're only aware of it if they've gone to the doctor and had their blood pressure checked.
Absolutely.
And then the problem is keeping them on the medication because there are no symptoms.
That's right. Elevated blood pressure can be very, very silent. And the first episode might be an actual event where you find out about it, whether it's a stroke or a heart attack.
That's how it got labeled the silent killer, I guess.
All right. It is. And another risk factor, diabetes. So diabetes is a very big risk factor for heart disease. In fact, we consider it a risk equivalent, meaning it's the same kind of risk as if you've already had a heart attack. And when we look at the differences in gender, diabetic women carry a higher risk than diabetic men.
And how about this? One of our recent guests, I think they said this, and Tracy, you have a better memory than me, that about 50% of patients who have a heart attack today have diabetes.
Yeah, I believe that is correct, or at least pre-diabetic, glucose intolerance, and something called metabolic syndrome, which sort of all ties together.
And I think that it's important to also mention that a lot of people who have diabetes, it's because of their obesity. Mm-hmm. Huge risk factor, right?
And that's weight. So we talked about the diet being important, but weight is critically important. And we've heard all the campaigns out there and the advertisements. We are getting bigger and bigger as a society. Our children are bigger than they should be. So that's why we believe heart disease is showing up even younger, because our children and teenagers are obese.
All right, one more question before you, Tracy. And that does it make a difference whether you're heart-shaped or pear-shaped?
Yeah, there is a difference. And actually, some very exciting research has come out recently about where you carry your fat. Mm-hmm. So we talk a lot about BMI, which is your body mass index, and that is important. But what's more important is whether you carry that spare tire. So if you have increased fat around the middle, that's actually more important than your overall BMI.
And you remember that that is Dunlap's disease.
Dunlap, yeah.
Yeah, your stomach Dunlap over your belt.
He loves that. He loves that. Right. Okay, now I want to flip this around, because one of the other facts that I have here is that 90% of women have one or more of those risk factors. So, all right, you can say the smoking, that's easy, the diet, but the blood, which is the one that trips women up the most? When you say 90% of women have one or more of those risk factors.
You know, it's sort of probably being overweight and sedentary. So we didn't talk about exercise, but I would have to say that that's a huge risk factor, is being sedentary and overweight. High blood pressure, as we all get older, we're more at risk, and it carries a bigger risk in women, elderly women, particularly for stroke. So, you know, that exists, and it all ties together. If you are overweight and sedentary, you're potentially more likely to have high blood pressure. So again, things tie in together. And like Tom said, the risk of diabetes is higher if you are heavier. So I think a lot of it really goes back to some of these lifestyle choices that we make.
How about stress?
Yeah, that's always a difficult one. Yeah, stress plays a role, but we're not fully aware of how it plays a role. I mean, it's good to have some level of stress in the sense that it drives us, it gets us to get our work done, it keeps us on our toes. But is too much stress a bad thing? Potentially, if it ends up being sort of an overwhelming factor in your day-to-day life, it can certainly make your blood pressure run higher. So again, we don't have a lot of knowledge about how stress relates, because it's probably how you deal with stress that's important as well.
The other risk factor, family history. If some people in your family have died of a heart attack or heart disease at a young age, that's a pretty significant risk factor too, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Family history plays a big role. And it seems like it may play a bigger role in women than men. We don't exactly know why, but it does play a role. And we hear all the time, well, you know what, I'm doomed to have heart disease because I have family history. There's nothing I can do about it. And that's something we really wanted to, you know, say, that that's not true. Yes, you can't pick who you were born to. The genetics exist, but you can do the other things to make sure you keep your other risk as low as possible. And you can, you know, sort of cheat that fate, so to speak.
It's just the cards that you were dealt. It's how you play them that makes the difference.
Absolutely.
Oh, Tracy, that was good.
Take that, Dunlaps.
So now we know what the risk factors are, and we absolutely need to know how to control them. And some of the things are relatively straightforward. If you're obese, you got to lose weight. If you're a smoke, you got to quit. If you've got diabetes, you got to keep your blood pressure or your blood sugar under control. A couple of other things that are touted in the media and even by people in your department are fish oil and aspirin. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion on those two?
Well, fish oil, extremely beneficial. Initially, the literature suggested that it was just for people who'd already had a heart attack. And now we think that the benefit exists for everyone. However, the question is how best do you get your fish oil or your omega-3? It looks like if you really had it in your diet, with including the fish twice a week in your diet, that that's probably the best way to get the omega-3. But the capsules, you know, they're available. You have them. You need to talk to your doctor about them, about what's the right dose. Fish oil helps triglyceride levels. So that's one reason we might put a patient on a fish oil, is to help improve their triglyceride level. But independent of that, it seems to help the heart arteries out as well and decrease cardiovascular events. But you want to, again, be careful of the dosing that you take and talk to your doctor about what's the right dose for you.
And baby aspirin?
Yes. So aspirin. For men, we know that there's a benefit for both heart attacks and strokes sort of throughout a man's life. But again, something you need to talk to your doctor about, looking at your risk profile. For women under the age of 65, we don't see as much benefit for a daily aspirin in a woman. Over the age of 65, there's a clear benefit for both stroke and heart disease. Under 65, again, if you have risks, other risk factors, then an aspirin may very well be beneficial for you.
So we're talking about fish oil and aspirin. Let's talk one more over-the-counter vitamin D. Does vitamin D have any effect on a healthy heart?
It very well might if you are vitamin D deficient.
Okay.
So I think something that's come out recently is not everybody needs every supplement. I think we're prone to say, well, boy, there's all these things out there. The more, the merrier.
Sure.
But some of the data has suggested that maybe that's not the case. And really look at your diet and it is healthy. And if you are deficient in a vitamin, then taking supplements may be appropriate.
Heart attacks. And that ties into the aspirin, because I think you're a proponent of, if you think you're having a heart attack, whether you're a man or a woman, first call 911. But second of all, choose some aspirin. What are the most common symptoms for women who are having a heart attack? And are they truly different than in a man?
I'll start with the second part. I believe they are different from a man. So that's the first thing we have to realize. And I think that's why there's a delay for women calling 911 or getting into the hospital, because they don't believe they're having a heart attack, because they don't have that classic chest pain, hand over the middle of the chest feeling necessarily. Now, chest pain still is a prevalent symptom for a heart attack, but it's usually milder in a woman. And there's more associated symptoms such as shortness of breath, feeling this fatigue and just not feeling the energy to sort of get up and go. And you need to recognize those symptoms as possibly being related to your heart and make that phone call.
And it's really important, no matter what the symptoms are, if you even think it might be related to your heart, you ought to do something about it.
I agree. I always tell my patients, I'd rather tell you you're fine and say go home and it's not your heart than tell you a week later, did you know you had a heart attack?
All right. She is Dr. Rekha Mankad. This is Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Coming up, this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. And we'll also talk with our friend, the dietitian, Ms. Kate Zarewski.
Right.
You know, you live in Rochester, you think everybody's
That's
a doctor.
Right.
We'll talk about the best and the worst foods for your heart. Right after that, you can call us 507-282-1234 or contact us on our website or tweet us. This is Medical Edge Radio.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with a look at health and medical news. Researchers in Norway have found a link between taking folic acid before and during the first 8 weeks of pregnancy and a reduced risk of autism. Authors of the study, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, say it's already known that supplementation with folic acid around the time of conception reduces the risk of neural tube defects. They wanted to see if it also protects against other disorders such as autism. They say their main finding was that taking folic acid around the time of conception was associated with a lower risk of autism, but it's not a direct cause. They say more research is needed to explain this association. And in other news, according to a Mayo Clinic study, a molecule already implicated in a number of cellular functions can suppress the growth of tumors in the liver. Study author Dr. Ningling Kang says tumor cells are intelligent. They talk to the cells and their surroundings to change the way they behave and make the environment supportive of cancer growth. If we can disrupt the communication between the tumor cells and the tumor microenvironment, we can prevent tumor growth or metastasis in the liver.
Many cancers show a preference for liver metastases, such as colorectal cancer, lung cancer, pancreas cancer, breast cancers. Many patients eventually died of liver metastases and liver failure. It's very important to understand why the liver become a common site for liver metastases and develop strategies for preventing and treating liver metastases.
The findings give new insight into cancer metastasis, the ability of a tumor to spread from its primary site to distant organs such as the brain, lung, or liver, and the studies in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. Now, if I can only get a good night of sleep. How many of us have said that from time to time? Well, people who have lost hope that they'll ever get a good night's sleep again are at increased risk of suicide. It turns out that research in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine reports insomnia and nightmares are known risk factors for suicide, but just how it works is unknown. The new study reaffirms that link and adds the element of hopelessness. If the findings hold true in larger studies, they want to focus on intervention and prevention. And here's another study about how being physically active is good for you. Researchers from the Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health found adults who have weight loss or bariatric surgery and who are physically active afterwards are less likely to be depressed than those who aren't as active. They say often doctors manage depression in these people with counseling and or medication. And now they're looking at how physical activity could be an alternate treatment. They also say more studies are needed, but physical activity is definitely important to weight management and it may help mental health as well. And that's a look at health and medical news. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online. And don't forget, you can pick us up on iHeartRadio. How do you do that?
Well, just go to iHeartRadio.com, and our flagship station is KROC AM, and you can be listening to it right now.
Right, in your pocket.
Absolutely. It's time for you to join our conversation. Contact us by phone at 507-282-1234. You can go to our website at radio.mayoclinic.org or tweet us at hashtag Mayo Radio. Now, I don't know why you had to do this to me, Tom, and wreck my week, but earlier this week, Tom sent me an email about the 10 or the worst foods for your heart. And I thought, well, if we have to talk about this, let's get Kate Zaratsky on the line. She's a dietitian at Mayo Clinic. Good morning, Kate.
Hey. Good morning.
Hey, Kate, I gave you an honorary doctorate degree this morning.
Just
Oh, you did? Yeah, Lee Acey last week. I made him a doctor,
so
you might as well be a doctor, too.
Well, thank you, Dr. Guy.
You're welcome. Kate Zaratsky, glad to have you with us.
Now, let's talk about because we are talking about healthy hearts, let's talk about the worst foods for your heart, and then we'll end on a positive note by talking about some better ones. But this
Turn my headphones off.
Yeah, this list has got some of my favorite things on it, Kate.
It does. Well, you know, and let's preface this by saying that there maybe are the worst foods, but everything in moderation.
True. Now, there were some things that didn't surprise me, like Alfredo sauce, you know, that, well, and plus, trying to eat a whole serving of that is going to be tough anyway.
Not hard at all.
But I do have to say there was one that surprised me, and that was processed meats. Now, not hot dogs or bacon, but just even deli meats is on that list, and that surprised me.
Right. And, you know, there's been some research around processed meats and looking at some of the preservatives in processed meats, mainly the nitrates or nitrites that are in some of those leaner deli meats that a lot of us are using in our lunch sandwiches and such. So what they're looking at is, does that potentially harden our arteries? Is it causing damage to our arteries and not so great for our hearts?
And so I have seen when I'm buying deli meat that there are some brand, they're a lot more expensive, but you can get some that don't have these in it, and that would be worth the extra money, I guess, to not have those nitrites in there.
Right, and I think that that's the one of the positives is that food manufacturers are looking at alternative ways to still give us a quick and more convenient food, but have it for us in a healthier manner, maybe using a preservative just still to keep our food safe, but not necessarily be detrimental to our bodies.
So now how do you know? I mean, we're talking about lunch meat. How do you know which one is the good one and which one is the bad one for your heart?
You check that label.
Well,
right.
And what are we looking for? Nitrites?
So you'll see now they're actually labeled right on the front of the package that will say nitrate free, or they may say uncured. That might be another term that you can see right on the front of the package.
All right, got it. What else you got on your list that's not good for my heart?
As long as we're talking about meats and processed meats, we could roll right into some of the red meats or higher fat meats. If you look at both of those things maybe even together. There was a study done about, maybe 2 years ago that looked at processed and red meats both being culprits in, say, slowly but steadily raising our weight year to year, even in people who maybe weren't at risk of, say, being overweight or obese, but even people who are just, you know, everyone who wants to watch their weight. And when we think about our heart health, the just keeping our weight in check is important as well. When we think about just the regular meats, we want to choose ones that are more lean, and of course just watch our portion. And in doing those two things, not only are we going to watch our overall calorie intake, but then we'll also watch our saturated fat intake, which has been a culprit in poor heart health.
Tom, you need to just stay away from that 72-ounce ribeye challenge. Just walk right past it and don't do it. Another thing that's on here, Kate, that I thought was interesting was sodas. How is soda bad for your heart?
Well, sodas and any sugary beverage, because it's just mainly sugar and maybe some other flavorings, it doesn't really have any nutritional value. And again, going back to looking at our overall weight, and there might be that connection there with overweight and obesity. However, just sugar alone, if someone has diabetes or doesn't, extra sugar isn't really anything that we need in our diet. And sure, I think there's that question of, you know, can it be even just, irritating to kind of the overall system in terms of with our liver and the processing that happens there. And it could be irritating in raising our triglycerides, which, again, not good for our heart health.
All right. What about diet soda? Is that okay?
Well, surprisingly, you know, think, oh, diet soda, there's no sugar, there's artificial sugar in that, so that should be better. Well, in terms of weight, maybe, but maybe not. And there's been an association there, and it's a little less clear why, but there seems to be an association with poor health related to people who drink diet soda in addition.
Let's end on an upswing here. Give us a couple of foods that we should be trying in the new year, trying to start new healthier habits. What's a healthy heart food that we should try to add in?
Well, and if we've been talking a lot about protein, so instead of meat, or maybe if we're eating meat less often, maybe looking at fish. Our American dietary guidelines recommend that we get 2 fish meals in each week. Fish is a lean source of protein and also has the healthy fats, the omega-3 fats that are potentially not only helpful to our heart, but maybe our brains and in our bodies as a whole. So fish is a great thing to add. Also, fruits and vegetables. If you look at any of the foods that we talked about, and this is where moderation comes in, keep you balance anything you eat, the other half of the plate, with more fruits and vegetables, you're going to get more nutrients overall, more vitamins, more minerals, more phytonutrients, in addition to fiber. And fiber has also been shown to be that one key thing that can help reduce our cholesterol.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Mayo Clinic dietitian Kate Zaratsky, and she and I kind of set this up in advance. And I, on our webpage, radio.mayoclinic.org, have a couple of recipes, because I love recipes.
Oh, good.
So we've got baked salmon with Southeast Asian marinade. And then the one I'm really excited to try is the black bean and corn relish that you can use in a lot of different ways. So both of those recipes are there.
Very versatile recipes, yes.
And I'll even put the list of the foods that you should avoid. I don't have that up there yet, Dr. Shives, but I'll put that on there
for
you, too.
And if I do that, I'll probably starve to death.
Again, that's radio.mayoclinic.org. Thanks, Kate. We appreciate your time.
Nice chatting with you. Have a great day.
All right. Bye-bye.
We are back with Dr. Rekha Mankad. She is a women's health expert at the Mayo Clinic. Time for you to join our program. Our telephone number, 507-282-1234. And by the way, we have a couple of complimentary copies of the book, Mayo Clinic Healthy Heart for Life.
Excellent.
For a couple of our callers. And we also have tweets and from our blog questions.
I've got all sorts of tweets for you. First of all, Sue wants to know, does red wine help with heart disease?
So, how to answer this? A little bit of wine can be beneficial to the heart. But we don't advocate that you go out and start drinking red wine to help your heart. There's a lot of other things that are probably better. But there is some there's something in the red wine that seems to help heart disease. But if you look at the risks and the benefits overall, for women, a glass, just one, of alcohol, and it could be anything, but preferably red wine, can help you. But you have to look at whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, sure. and then the risks may outweigh those benefits.
All right. Another tweet, does secondhand smoke contribute to heart disease?
Secondhand smoke likely does have some contribution to heart disease. It's less well studied. There's not a lot of literature out there on it, but we do believe that it contributes to an increased risk of heart disease, especially if you are in close proximity to it. So if there is someone in the car that's smoking or in the house that's smoking where that smoke sort of stays in the air and you're breathing that in, there is likely some increased risk for you as well. Not as prominent as if you are actually smoking, but still risk. So I always tell people, have the whole house quit at the same time.
And isn't it interesting that since the regulation went into effect, the law went into effect where you can't smoke in restaurants in Minnesota, the incidence of heart attacks is down significantly.
Absolutely, yes. It's a real risk. I mean, tobacco is a real, real risk, whether you're doing it yourself or if you're around other people that are smoking.
All right, 507-282-1234. If you have a question about your heart or heart disease, Dr. Rekha Mankad, and we have two complimentary copies of the book for our callers.
Absolutely. Now, right before the bottom of the hour, we started to touch on this, and I want to go back to it with a myth or matter of fact. I know I'm having a heart attack because my chest and arm will hurt. Is that a myth or a matter of fact?
That is a myth. So you don't need to just have chest pain or arm pain for it to be a heart attack. And again, that's a bit more common in women where they might not have that classic symptom. But for all patients, men and women alike, it doesn't have to just be chest pain. It can be shortness of breath that's out of proportion to anything that you're doing at the time. It can be nausea. It can be a sweating where you just break out in a sweat. You can have discomfort between your shoulder blades. You can have jaw pain. So you really need to be cognizant of your symptoms. And if you don't feel right and have any of these things and you can't attribute it to anything else, best to be cautious.
All right, 507-282-1234. A few minutes remaining with Dr. Rekha Mankad. Coronary artery disease, that's the real culprit, isn't it? And that is where you get hardening of the arteries that supply the heart, and a plaque forms in there, and that's actually what a heart attack is?
That's correct. That's what is the process of having a heart attack. So plaque builds up in the arteries, and that takes a long time, and that's why we talk about making sure our children are healthy, because this process takes years and decades for that plaque to sort of start lining the arteries. And as it does, the arteries get more and more narrowed. But suddenly something can rupture that plaque, and that's when the artery closes off suddenly, and that's a heart attack.
And it's very important. You take the aspirin to prevent that clot from progressing and getting worse, right? And you get to the hospital in time because you and your colleagues, the interventional cardiologists, can actually stop a heart attack, right?
That's correct. We can abort it. So what's happening when you're having a heart attack is that artery is closed off and the muscle that's being supplied by that artery is getting starved of oxygen. So our goal is to get that artery opened up as quickly as possible to prevent any damage to the heart muscle.
And how much time do you have?
You know, the best thing is to get in as quickly as possible. We want you in as soon as you start having symptoms. So earlier is better. Really, we have benefit for a while, but more benefit up front. So
we
can get in with 30 minutes.
We're talking
30 to 60 minutes.
Yeah, okay. So you got to get there fast.
John is on the line. He has a question about fish oil, and he is going to get one of these Mayo Clinic Healthy Heart for Life books. So hold on the line when we're done here, John. Go right ahead with your question.
Very good. I missed earlier in the program what the doctor said about fish oil, whether it was beneficial or not.
Yeah, and I wanted to follow up on that with, how do you know, because you're buying fish oil over the counter, how do you know which is the good fish oil to buy? If you don't get it through your food, let's go there.
Well, as far as the fish oil, yes, it is beneficial, John. So we do say that fish oil is beneficial. And I think as we heard from the dietitian, it's best if you can have 2 servings of fish a week. That's probably the best way to get it in, because supplementing your diet that way is the best. As far as the pills over the counter, I can't tell you that there's a specific brand, but you want to have something that says it's omega-3 fish oil. But you really want to talk to your doctor about what's the right dose for you. We don't want you to take too much fish oil over 3 3 grams a day may not be a good thing because it does thin your blood a little bit as well. So we want to make sure that you're getting the right amount and really looking at your diet as well and what your cholesterol is to make sure we come up with the right dosing.
Hey, John, thanks so much for your call. We'll send you a copy of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Heart for Life book. Congratulations, and thanks for being with us.
Yep, hold on the line, and Audrey will get your information. And I should say that and other Mayo Clinic publications and DVDs can be purchased at the Mayo Clinic store or online at mayoclinic.com. Click mayoclinic.com bookstore. What is the difference between a heartburn and a chest pain or discomfort? Because people say, I don't want to go to the emergency room. I'm going to find out it's just heartburn.
Heartburn and heart versus heart attack.
You know, it's a symptom. So that's the first thing you have to realize. I mean, everybody feels things differently. So it's hard to say. Somebody might describe their symptom as a burning in their chest, and that very well could be a symptom of a heart attack. So you need to listen to your body and decide if it's something that's abnormal for you and happening where it's fairly profound. And I tell my patients who have heart disease, who have symptoms related to their heart disease, see what symptoms seems to correlate with when you've been found to have heart disease. You know, your symptoms before your stent, symptoms before bypass surgery. And if you get different symptoms, maybe it's not your heart. But again, you have to be aware of it and talk to your doctor.
All right. 507-282-1234. Susan has a question about plaque in the heart. Good morning, Susan.
Yeah, good morning. I'm just wondering if you can reverse the plaque in your arteries with your diet.
That's a great question.
Yeah, that is a great question.
Oh, and by the way, hang on, Susan. You will receive a complimentary copy of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Heart for Life book. Thanks for joining us.
All right, so
go ahead.
So as far as reversing the plaque, once the plaque is there, it's there. We can do things with our diet to stabilize the plaque, meaning to make that plaque less likely to rupture. As actually making the plaque go away, we can do a little bit for that, but we don't make it completely go away. Cholesterol medicines have been shown to regress the plaque a bit, but really the goal is to try to make that plaque not get bigger and to make sure that it's not going to rupture, which is when you would have a heart attack.
Thanks so much, Susan. Do you think there will be a point in time where if you have plaque in your arteries anywhere, including the heart, that you can put a catheter up there and Roto-Rooter out that plaque?
Well, we actually do that. There is procedures in the cath lab where you can actually sort of scrape away some of that plaque. But again, it's in the setting of somebody who's having symptoms or has a stress test that might be abnormal, something that's related to the plaque. And when we do these angioplasty procedures, sometimes we do have to scrape away the plaque. But the goal is to never have the plaque there to begin with. And perhaps down the road, there's going to be different growth factors that we can use and other alternative therapies to try to regress that plaque.
All right. We've talked about the risk factors, and we wanted to emphasize prevention. So let's spend the last 40 seconds or so talking about things that people can do, men and women, to have a healthy heart, just like the book would suggest.
I think one of the key things is move. You want to be as active as possible. Even if you can get up 10 more minutes during the day to move, I think it's great benefit for you. I think we really need to put exercise into our daily regimen and schedule it like we do a lot of other things and really maintain our weight. I think that's the two goal things from lifestyle. And we do that by watching our diet, eating healthy, exercising, and knowing our risk factors. Those are very important for assessing our risk.
And you can, if you have high blood pressure or if you have diabetes, you can help prevent developing heart disease if you keep your blood pressure under control and keep your blood glucose under control.
Absolutely. Those are absolutely correct statements.
It's really quite straightforward. Dr. Rekha Mankad, thanks so much for being with us.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Tom. Tracy.
You're listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program, and it's exciting, and you're going to like it because it's a little bit of research. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio, we'll talk with Mayo researcher Dr. William Fabian and gastroenterologist Dr. Joseph Murray. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the Gates Foundation, right?
Yeah, Bill and Melinda Gates. I think they've thrown a little bit of money around with that foundation,
haven't
they?
Exactly. He started Microsoft, and he is now the second richest man in the world. But fortunately, you know, the Gates want to give back to the rest of the world. And it's a huge thing because they not only want to help people here in the United States, but globally, they They want to help, and the primary aim of their foundation is to overcome extreme poverty on the one hand, and also create new and better health solutions for the developing world.
That's right. Two researchers from Mayo recently received a Gates Foundation grant to study a bowel condition that interferes with digestion and stunts the growth and, frankly, kills over 100 million infants in developing countries.
And you know what's interesting is I didn't even know about this condition or know how widespread it was. Well, we'll talk with Dr. William Fabian and GI specialist Dr. Joseph Murray next week on Medical Edge Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website. Ooh, those recipes are there too. radio.mayoclinic.org. Or you can visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to better manage your health.
Any of those recipes made with Alfredo sauce?
Not there.
You've been listening to Medical Edge Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Radio and Dr. Rekha Mankad, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.